I said, get the leader. Okay, when the tape ended, we were talking about establishing the library in Saigon.
Yeah, it was it was the National Institute of Administration, to which our whole program was attached. And the library was non-existent until that point. We did put up a pretty good facility. Just one small item in the many things that I was involved in Vietnam.
How was it that they made it a family affair? I mean, it seemed like if power wasn't consolidated and yet their families were invited, do you think that was a mistake in retrospect? Or
we didn't lose any.
Oh.
a lot of the families had quite an adventure. I think those that were there at the beginning, like we were, had a substantial adventure, as I've been describing it. After, incidentally, I learned a pretty basic lesson in the process, because the French and many of the Americans were saying this ZM government can never amount to anything. It can't keep control of the streets. It's unable to govern. And the ZM people, and I knew what they were saying because it wasn't that West was there, but Ed Widener was chief advisor and was in touch with the presidency. And Jack, let's see, at that time we had an advisor to the Sûreté, a man by the name of Boudrias. And Boudrias used to be right in the middle of discussions that were occurring in the police headquarters, and several of our other police advisors were too. And we heard from Diem's government that these aren't Vietnamese who are opposing the government. These are the French who are trying to discredit the government. You know, I couldn't believe that the French, our allies, freedom, independence, and so forth, would be doing anything that sneaky as to blow up some of the government buildings and to create havoc on the streets of Saigon. After all, we Western countries don't play the game that way. This must be something else. So I didn't know who to believe. But after a month, about 4 weeks of this stuff, they caught two bomb setters driving in a Jeep. One of them got out and was planting the bomb at the front of a big bank building in downtown Saigon, plastic bomb. The other one was sitting in the Jeep, when the police caught him. And these were two legionnaires who were on the payroll of the plantation owners, loaned to them by the government, and they were trying to do exactly what Diem had described, namely to upset everybody to the point where the Diem government couldn't survive. So it was clearly in the hands of the French, the turmoil that we lived through in that period, other than the initial riot, which I described, the initial hotel looting, which the young people themselves took on as a result of the protest that was organized.
The informal contacts that were made at that time, did the MSU members of the Vietnam Project, did they have contacts at the U.S. Embassy, or did they have, were they invited parties, or
sure, I mean,
there
weren't many parties in those days, but there was certainly a lot of informal contact. For one thing, everybody was trying to get established, and the Michigan State group was very prominent. We were very large. We became very large. I'm not going to give you the whole history step by step. I'm sort of jumping into the middle of it. But after a couple of years, we had 30 people on site, and then we went up to 50 people on site. And we always had ties with the embassy because the ambassador considered what we were doing to be extremely important and wanted to talk from time to time to see what we were doing. And AID, of course, its predecessor being the Foreign Operations Administration, was our sponsor. So what we were doing was, in a very broad sense, supervised by AID. I don't like the word supervised because we were on our own, but financed by AID and supported and sustained. If we needed, we got into a big hassle the first 6 months when Ed was out there, Ed Widener, because our business office could not write piastre checks. That was a currency locally. Mm-hmm. Yet we had a local payroll. We had well over 100 people after a year or so on the MSU payroll. These were drivers. These were sweepers in the building and all that stuff.
and interpreters as well. So we had to figure out a way of paying these employees, and we did not have an ability to write checks. For various business and accounting rule reasons, we did not. And we wanted AID's predecessor, it wasn't AID then, to take over on the payrolling. But there, too, you run into questions when the government hires somebody and payrolls them. They have to go through certain kinds of procedures and have certain kinds of... It's a different relationship than when the university... And when the university did it, they couldn't pay them. So we were in turmoil. We went to the mat on this issue with the government, with FOA, our sponsors. It was to the point where Widener was threatening to withdraw the MSU team from the field because we couldn't operate unless we could pay for the things that we were using, including employees. Finally, after quite a bit of tension, we did get that settled, and it got settled on the basis of Phil May, who was then the vice president for business, agreeing to write the checks based on the kind of documentation we had to provide. So we were sending stuff back and forth through the APO system that never should have been. There should have been a simple way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Somebody should have been able to break through that.
And Phil May was here back in East Lansing.
Yeah, he was in East Lansing. We'd get our checks from East Lansing, piastres, written out. So, we cashed them in Saigon mm-hmm. in some way. He would only issue the check against a list of receipts and so forth that we would send. And we'd get the money, and then we'd write the check locally because we had a bank account then. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a detail you don't have to have to worry about. But there were a lot of other relationships. We had a police advisory group, which was a very sensitive operation. Evidently, Hannah had agreed when the National Security Council contacted us, not us, but him, had agreed that we would make use of the recruitment of some intelligence officers to be a part of the training of the Sûreté. Sûreté being the French intelligence and security police.
Or the Vietnamese?
The name came from France.
Okay.
But the Vietnamese, right. Okay. Yeah.
They kept that.
Yeah, they kept name. That title. We kept calling it the VBI, Vietnamese Bureau of Investigation. So we had in our midst one person who was seconded from the CIA to the Michigan State Group. And it was no big secret to anybody who looked at it. I never looked at it, and I didn't. He was on the police team. I didn't know any of the police team. For the guy who headed it was Howard Hoyt, a very able chief of police from Kalamazoo, Michigan. So you know that's quite a jump from Kalamazoo, Michigan to Saigon, Vietnam. But nevertheless, Howard was capable and able to do this, and he had a team of four or five people at that time. It grew to eight, and then later it grew to about 20. So it was a substantial part of the Michigan State involvement. So since we had the Sûreté to train, we had a lot of contact with the other agencies that were involved in intelligence work. We were making use of the CIA or DIA or whatever it was that was nominated to Art Brandstetter, who was the head of our School of Police Administration, and Art would pick and choose among them and hire one or another. They would second them to us. They'd be on our payroll and under our discipline, in the sense that when I was chief of party, I could have sent any of them home. That we assured ourselves of, because we did get rid of one, not get rid of him, but we shortened his stay. Mm-hmm. Because of that function of dealing with the police, we were also dealing quite a bit with the U.S. embassy people that are interested in that whole array. And at AID, they were trying to help us out here and there, but they were completely incapable in the early years of dealing with police administration and police Sûreté type stuff or any other. We had municipal police, we had rural police, which were the Guard Civile. We likened them to the state police. They're not an exact parallel by any stretch of the imagination, but they were one of three different police forces that we worked with. We never worked with the gendarmes, the the army police, they had their own training mechanism. But we eventually built helped the Vietnamese to build up a school of police administration and police training. And we worked with all three of them, all three branches in that context.
Mm-hmm. Was Ralph Turner involved at that time?
He came out later, yeah. Mm-hmm. He was there when I was there for my second tour.
Second, okay. The
he was there as a consultant, as I recall, earlier than that, but he was. Mm-hmm. You see, the Michigan State, in accepting the obligation to train and prepare the Vietnamese police services, accepted it for all three of the civilian services. And I think that's the way it should have been. But it became an overwhelming thing for us, and we, by 1957, had decided to get out of it. I mean, reduce it considerably. And when I went out as chief of party in 1950, early 58, one of the things I did immediately was to get in with the CIA and negotiate the withdrawal of our role in the Cerate, and negotiated with AID to be sure they had the capability at that time to pick up on the police. Now, you know, there's been a lot written about that, but very rarely by that a lot of people like to chew on that and talk about this undercover activity. Let me tell you that undercover in the field was everybody knew who was working in the intelligence portion of the police division, and everybody knew, including the Vietnamese, because I personally took that up with Go Dinh Diem before we expanded to include any more than the small handful at the very beginning. Diem knew, his whole government knew, all the Michigan State people in the field knew, AID knew, anybody who hung around the airport knew, because when a new person came in, it was always a ritual to be met. And if you were met by one of the wives of the embassy CIA crowd, and they were all known, then people would know that this was so the whole business of secretiveness is sort of silly. In fact, the names were read over the radio from North Vietnam. But you see, it fit into a nice pattern for people who came along later, mm-hmm. to try to make use of the secretiveness and so forth. It was understandable, but it was a dramatic distortion. Every one of them was required to be under the discipline of I'm talking about the intelligence people now, mm-hmm. under the discipline of the chief advisor and his man, the police advisor, chief police advisor.
Thank you.
And they were. We were told that they could only participate in training activities. But when you're dealing with the intelligence services, you can't ever really verify what anybody does between 10 o'clock at night and 2 in the morning. Mm-hmm. We believe that these were all trainees. They reported to us, and they reported on the training they were engaged in. But it was an interesting period.
Were there any other American universities that were doing similar things?
In the police field, we heard that there were others. Glenn Taggart later told me, but I have no firsthand knowledge. The Cornell Southeast Asia Center, I think, was at one time pretty well known as having been writing reports for the intelligence services, but I couldn't verify that. Mm-hmm. And besides, by the time I left, we were out of that business on the Cerate side, and we were largely out of the police administration advisory role.
By 1958?
When I left in late 59.
Oh, 59, yeah. Okay. How would you describe the political situation in Vietnam?
Very tense to begin with, because when you say political, I would say it was evolving. We were there during two elections, and when I think back on it, those were spectacular developments in the sense that in the midst of all of this and the uncertainty, there was an election held, a referendum to put Diem in as president, to move Bao Dai out. And many Vietnamese that I've talked to really resented that. They had an admiration for Bao Dai and the, and the and the lineage that he represented. But nevertheless, there was a big election, and many of us were out on the streets when the balloting was counted and went over to the polling booths to see what was going on, and witnessing the significance of a election actually occurring at that, a referendum occurring at that. Then later there was the election that put in the first constituent assembly, and a constitution was then formed, and we participated to some extent in that. And then by that I mean we brought out an advisor on constitutional law, a man from UCLA who was a consultant to our group and worked with the Vietnamese as they spelled out their constitutional law issues. And I forget what his name was, but he was quite prominent. In any case, we had also the election of the first legislative, the first legislature. And that, too, when you think about it, we're talking about a country that is divided, going through all of this turmoil, all this difficulty, and here it is holding elections. So we observed this kind of political evolution. There was a lot of, there were many positive things happening in that period of 1956. I wouldn't include 55 because in those early months the country was still in turmoil, which I've described. Mm-hmm. But shortly after 55 wended its way off the calendar, we were able to go out in the countryside quite easily, comfortably. We were able to, so the country was settling down. There were disturbing reports by the time I left of assassinations in the countryside, that the local officials were being singled out if they were loyal to Diem and being killed. And those reports I heard from time to time at the meetings at the U.S. operations, USAM, the aid program headquarters. There were disturbing reports of the government being non-responsive, and those came from Americans. You'd hear Americans saying, "Oh, it's never like this back home. You know, we could do this and that." And I can tell you that, on hindsight, after all of, and especially since I've been writing this book, that I think that this period of lack of understanding of the process Americans were going through probably did as much harm as anything else to unseat the government of Diem later on. I think one could document that. It would be an interesting book. But here you had a bunch of Americans in our group, but mainly from USAM and from all over, looking for something ideal and finding something considerably less and becoming critical. Inevitably, it was considerably less than ideal. And you found a kind of griping and nonsense. Remember, I used to go out in the countryside, and here I'm mixing the 55, 56 time with the 58, 59 time, because this was a spread of 5 years over. I was there practically all the time. 1 year we were back in East Lansing having our third child, who went back with us later. But we had Michigan State people, one economist, another economist, who formed very strong views on how inadequate the Vietnamese economic improvement, inadequate their planning was and their efforts. And as I think back on it, they were really incapable of handling the kinds of issues that they were dealing with, which were really political economy in its most, in its rarest form. Mm-hmm. Milt Taylor, our tax advisor, went around and wrote a report finally, and went around talking about the progressive income tax, a very uncreative way of trying to deal with Vietnamese tax policy in those days. But he went on record, and I remember asking him to come in and talk with me one day when I was chief advisor about why he had to put up front on the third page of the report a damning reference to this government: "You'll never be anything until you put into effect
a progressive income tax. I said, you know, does it have to be said in a take it or leave it, you know, sense, or as a report writer and a consultant who has been admitted to the inner circle of information, can't you say something that would be not require Vietnamese readership and Vietnamese leaders to not just cringe, but to take offense and eventually to reject everything else in your report because you're so one-sided on the issue? Well, Ralph, when everything is said and done, you just got to tell it the way it is. You know, that's not exactly technical advisor in the best sense. Mm-hmm. And Milton was a good guy, but he was looking for something that he could never find in the overseas setting. He looked for it in Panama, too, mm-hmm. later on under government auspices. Mm-hmm. And that's only one example, mm-hmm. but I single that out because Milton went back and wrote a devastating article about how horrible the government was, how badly it was, how the U.S. was being taken.
Was that, how was that article received in Vietnam?
It caused that article plus one or two others. We had Adrian Jaffe, whom you may know. He's in the arts and letters arena. Adrian came out not as a consultant to the project, but because of so many of us being out there, he came out as a Fulbrighter. And I remember going up to his apartment with our kids, Lil and I. Adrian was an old friend from East Lansing. He was sort of a curmudgeon, but he was a bright one. And Adrian, he was telling us about what he was into, how he's having so much trouble at the university and so forth as a Fulbrighter. At one point, the toilet flushed because our seven-year-old, I think Gary was about seven then, had gone in to use his bathroom. And he said, did he flush my toilet? Adrian almost jumped out the window. He was so upset. He said, I get one flush a day, and your kid went in there and flushed my toilet.
Oh, no.
You can see the conditions under which we lived weren't exactly the luxury conditions that some people have described. No. In any case, Adrian came back and wrote an article about how terrible this thing was in Vietnam. Milt Taylor wrote an article like that. And Frank Child, who was another economist from Michigan State, wrote that kind of an article. And they had very negative views. The country was not living up as quickly to their ideals. And they were in no position to judge, but they judged. And they went way beyond their areas of specialization. They talked about politics when really they were economic analysts. They talked about issues in the government that they really knew very little about. But when you're, like all of us, a professor, and you come into a juicy situation, you can put an article in the New Republic. We're tempted beyond what we should be to be just that. In any case, as a result of this, when the contract was up for renewal, we were requested by the government. By this time, Al Seeley, who was head of the business college, was involved heavily because the project shifted. It was always under our international program office in the early 60s as well as earlier. But it came into being, incidentally, before the international program was created. It was under political science and the Governmental Research Bureau initially. And later, when our international program dean's office was created, all international projects came under that jurisdiction. And then later, Al Seeley, whose people were heavily involved in the field, insisted on having more control. And Glenn Taggart yielded to that desire. That was our general philosophy. If a project's heavily involved in a college, it ought to be administered through that college with certain residual control staying in the central dean's office. And Seeley was out in the field, actually, when Ziem unloosed the idea that unless he could have assurances from the university that our people would not write critical articles and publicly denounce him as they were. Unless that happened, he would not renew the contract. So there was no way that any of us would have supported the idea that he would have that kind of control over what our people said.
And he said, look, your people are in my files, and it seems to me that they should respect the right of the government to control its own flow of information on such matters. But we couldn't do it. We wouldn't do it, and contract terminated. We had requested a final 2 years at a very reduced level in order to cement some of the good things that we'd seen. And we did accomplish some good things during the period.
What were some of those?
Well, I would say the resettlement of the refugees was a very significant development, which would not have occurred, I can say with without any hesitation, would not have occurred as anywhere near as well or as systematically without our direct involvement. We wrote the plan under which the Vietnamese government operated and under which the aid program operated, and which resettled almost 1 million refugees. I think we had 800 to 900,000 that were unsettled when we started to get into it. And I was out in the field with three or four of us in a team. We went all over the country, developed the plan. Diem and his refugee commissioner, Bui Van Luong, endorsed it. Well, his name was Luong, but not Bui Van. In any case, they endorsed it and they put it into effect. And when I came back a year later, the tents and temporary living arrangements that I saw when I first arrived in 1956 were gone. They'd been put in places where they could be productive. That movement was criticized by some because they say it was so outside of the ordinary. These were all Catholic refugees, and Vietnam's a Buddhist country. And there were references to the fact that some of them were placed in locations which made them sort of buffers between Cambodia and the rest of Vietnam. But all those criticisms, whether they were partially correct or wrong or whatever, really didn't make any difference. These were human beings who had to be resettled. And they were, and they became productive parts of the economy. Now, when I look at the refugee situation in the Middle East, for example, and think of the horrors of having refugee camps for decades, generations, I realize that what we did in Vietnam, and that was among the first of the big such developments the U.S. got into in Vietnam, what we accomplished there was a major accomplishment. Well, that was one thing. Another was our main goal was to establish a National Institute of Administration, which we did do, and we did it at a substantial level. It became a leader in the Eastern Region Organization for Public Administration. It began to develop a professional public administration, cadre, people, and some of them, a good number of them, came over to this country for advanced degrees, went back. So an institution, I think, had been built, and that's what we wanted to round out the final couple of years. In addition, there was a budget process put in place for the government. We had Marvin Murphy, one of the deputy budget directors in the state of Michigan, and a Michigan State friend. He'd been in and out of Michigan State classes for years. Frank Landers, who was director of the Michigan budget. They came out various times, and Marv was resident there, and developed a budget process, making use of primitive IBM equipment. We had counter sorters instead of IBM, full equipment. We had a colleague in Vuvan Thai, who became an outstanding administrator, took a high position in the UN development program later on, came from France to head the budget operation, and we worked with him, and Marvin Murphy was close to him and advised him, and they were working wonders. We had visitors from all over the region, all over South Asia and Southeast Asia, coming to see how this was working. So there was a kind of momentum of administrative adequacy that was coming in place. And of course, Diem would work 18 hours a day in his little cubbyhole office in the palace to get things going. He'd read everything that came across his desk, unfortunately. And the government was settling down. It was accomplishing things. There were public works, which we didn't do, but because the government could function, public works were putting in place. The railroad was reestablished up to Hue. And, well, a lot of good things that were beginning to happen until the assassinations in the countryside began to catch up, and the Diem government was put under so much pressure that Gaudin knew his brother increased the, I would say, the opportunities for corruption in order to maintain a political stability. And the country became much more corrupt by the time Diem was overthrown.
The communists were doing the assassination in the
Viet Cong.
In Viet Cong,
yeah,
right.
Who were communists. Mm-hmm. We always like to think of them. Mm-hmm. We did at that time. I was part of thinking of them as being Southerners who were anti-government, who were pro-independence, and who were communists. Turns out many of them were being led by the North in the whole movement. I think the history that had been written since then would show that these were hardly indigenous local people. They were, in many respects, masterminded by a much broader scheme than any of us realize. At one point,